Network Europe. Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest, I'm Gabby Katz. Welcome to this week's edition. Coming up, with North Korea touting its nuclear capability, condemnations and sanctions are on the lips of European leaders. Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya is mourned from Dresden to Stockholm. Colleagues across Europe say her murder was a blow to the freedom of the press in Russia. Nazdravi is too common a phrase amongst women in the Czech Republic as alcoholism soars. And a few middle-of-the-night phone calls let some people know that they've entered the hallowed halls of Nobel laureates. That and more in this edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. Do stay with us. North Korea's nuclear ambitions are clear, but how is the international community responding? Japan took action while the United Nations weighed sanctions against North Korea, and the U.S., Britain, and France sought a resolution under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter to make sanctions mandatory. And without sanctions, experts fear this could be a slippery slope. Joining me on Network Europe now is Shannon Kyle from SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're an expert on nonproliferation and export control. This week has been characterized by tension over North Korea's nuclear intentions. Now, Iran has reiterated its support of a global dismantling of nuclear capabilities. Do you think that's optimistic if we look in the short term?
Well, certainly in the short term, the trends in nuclear forces are running in exactly the opposite direction. The nuclear weapon states are all modernizing their forces. They've all reaffirmed the centrality of nuclear weapons in their long-term security postures. And in some cases, they're actually giving nuclear weapons expanded roles and missions in those postures. So in fact, in the short terms, the trends are not very optimistic.
North Korea is touting this as a success.
I think at this point, the nuclear forensics that's been done so far suggests that it was almost certainly a nuclear explosion. The question, I think, that's been raised by a lot of the data that's come to light so far is whether or not the test was a success or not, or more accurately, whether the test was perhaps, in fact, a partial failure.
North Korea, Iran, what do these countries gain by showcasing nuclear capabilities?
Iran steadfastly maintains that its nuclear program is entirely for peaceful purposes. And although there's considerable evidence that's been gathered by the International Atomic Energy Agency in the last year or so, which suggests at least that Iran's program may have a military component as well, there is no definitive proof of that yet. The difference with North Korea is North Korea in February of 2005 openly stated that it had developed operational nuclear weapons. And the test that was carried out last weekend, in fact, perhaps could be better described as a nuclear weapon demonstration, because the main purpose, as given by the North Koreans for carrying out the explosion, was to establish the credibility of their nuclear deterrent. And ironically, what's happened since then is that because there are now doubts about whether the test was a success or a failure, it's actually served to raise more questions than it answers about North Korea's nuclear weapon capability.
It seems North Korea has now let the genie out of the nuclear bottle. What should Europe be wishing for now?
I think Europe should be wishing for two things. The first thing is a cessation of further nuclear tests by North Korea. And the second thing is it needs to be part of a coordinated international response to what North Korea has done. And that may involve sanctions, it may involve some other punitive measures, but there needs to be, on the part of the international community, it can be through the UN Security Council or through a coordinated series of measures among individual states, but there needs to be a clear marker laid down that this is not acceptable and that North Korea has to desist from this behavior.
It's quite a week for a new Secretary General to be handed the United Nations chalice. South Korean Foreign Minister Ban Ki-moon was welcomed as the United Nations' new Secretary General. What role must he now play?
Well, clearly he has a major crisis on his hands. Obviously, the United Nations Security Council is going to be an important actor in responding to the North Korean test. It is the ultimate arbiter and upholder of international law. The question is going to become now, I think, what sort of coordinated response can there be among the five permanent members, especially since China and Russia are traditionally less willing to contemplate sanctions and punitive measures against member states. So he's going to have, I think, a very difficult task ahead of him in terms of coming up with a coordinated and unified response on the Security Council in a way that will also bring about meaningful and concrete punitive measures against the DPRK.
Thanks for that, Shannon Kyle. Staying with North Korea now, in fact, we're going to take you to the hot spot. Sweden, along with Switzerland, has had a presence in the demilitarized zone separating the North and South since 1953. On Wednesday, Radio Sweden's Dave Russell asked Commander Mats Fogelmark to describe the current situation on the ground. He's the deputy head of the Swedish delegation of the Neutral Nations Supervising Commission in Korea.
It's eye of the storm, because here in Panmunjom, the troops are always on high alert, so they are in that state of readiness already. We work in an area called Joint Security Area. It's a rather small area that is shared by the North Koreans and the South Koreans. And it's some kind of mutual understanding that they will do nothing here. So it's very calm and stable just here in the Joint Security Area.
And South Koreans, what do they say?
It was expected that they should blow that nuclear bomb, so no one is surprised at all.
This is Network Europe, broadcasting around the world, throughout Europe, and over the Internet. Still to come, Stockholm Calling. Some new Nobel laureates get that precious phone call. Stay with us. She was a Russian investigative journalist, but Anna Politkovskaya was mourned internationally. Her colleagues say her murder was retaliation for her reports on Chechnya, and indeed her legacy will forever be linked to the fight for press freedom. Radio Netherlands opened their vault to take us back to an interview they recorded in 1995 after the journalist fell seriously ill with symptoms of food poisoning after covering the Beslan hostage tragedy. She alleged that the Russian government poisoned her in an attempt to silence her reports on the war in Chechnya.
Meet Anna Politkovskaya.
We've returned to a time of poisoning. I'd like to remind people that the editor I work for was also poisoned in 2003 and died 10 days later. It's a typical Soviet method.
Absolutely Soviet method.
Anna and her editor's offense were to have reported negatively upon the war in Chechnya. No one can prove it, but it's thought the poisonings were government warnings to other journalists about reporting on the wrong stories, as it were.
We no longer have even one independent TV channel, and there's only one free radio station. That's really nothing for a big country like ours. The only thing left is the Internet and two or three independent newspapers.
Anna was one of 17 journalists who were physically attacked because of their work in 2004. And now there's another threat to press freedom in Russia, money.
The advertising market is under the monopoly control of the president. If you want advertising, you have to go to that one bureau. So then they say to you, if you don't publish a certain article, you'll get advertisers. Our newspaper is really poor. When our editor went to this bureau to ask for advertisers, he was told to cease producing stories on Chechnya and fire the journalist doing them, me.
And our reporter there was Margaret Stribos. Now, I said that Politkovskaya was mourned internationally, and indeed her funeral was attended by the head of the European Commission's delegation to Moscow, along with representatives from the EU's current Finnish presidency and ensuing German presidency. And on Tuesday, outside the Russian embassy in Stockholm, Swedish journalists demonstrated and lit candles in Politkovskaya's memory. The 48-year-old was one of Russian President Vladimir Putin's most vocal critics. But in his first public comments on the shooting, Putin vowed to hunt down the perpetrators and said he believed the killers wanted to stir up anti-Russian feeling. And without a doubt, the murder cast a shadow over Putin's two-day visit to Dresden, Germany. The annual bilateral deliberations are aimed at fostering Russian-German ties. Talks between German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Putin were this time also dominated by energy security and, of course, North Korea's nuclear crisis.
Vladimir Putin has described visits to Dresden as feeling like going home. The Russian president was based in the eastern German city in the 1980s as an agent of the former Soviet Union's KGB intelligence service. Angela Merkel, however, was less inclined to give President Putin an enthusiastic homecoming, as concerns about press freedom and human rights were on her mind. The German chancellor expressed her shock and dismay at the contract-style killing at the weekend of Anna Politkovskaya, a Russian investigative journalist and prominent Putin critic. Following their meeting, Vladimir Putin told the German press that everything would be done to track down the killers. I'd like to stress that we consider this murder as an abominable crime, he says. She was without a doubt a journalist who was highly critical of the government, but her killing has damaged Russia's reputation much more than her articles. All I can say is that we will do everything to bring the perpetrators to justice. An undertone of German concern was also perceptible at the talks over this country's dependency on Russian supplies of oil and gas. Memories of disruptions of Russian gas supplies to Europe still rankled with the German chancellor. However, Angela Merkel said she trusted Russia as a reliable business partner.
Wichtig für uns ist, dass wir uns einig sind auf der Basis der gleichen Prinzipien.
It is important for me to have realized that we are acting on the same business principles as the Russian government in this cooperation, she says. We are currently working out a joint charter in which these principles will be enshrined. As a matter of fact, I am not reluctant either to accept Russia's increasing importance in the business world, which is being reflected in the fact that Russian companies are buying themselves into European firms. The series of routine meetings of German and Russian leaders is known as the Petersburg Dialogue Forum, named after the Russian city where the first meeting was held in 2001. This year, the talks also covered issues such as the Middle East conflict, developments in Iraq, Afghanistan and the Balkans, as well as the nuclear ambitions of Iran and North Korea. Both leaders denounced last weekend's explosion of a nuclear device by North Korea as an irresponsible act. Mr. Putin, however, did not comment on whether his government would support sanctions against North Korea. On the sidelines of their meeting, the two leaders oversaw the signing of a raft of business deals. Russia's oil wealth has made companies from the country potent investors also in the German economy. Somewhat unusual evidence of that was a 100 million euro football sponsorship deal between the German Bundesliga club Schalke 04 and Russian oil giant Gazprom that was also signed on Tuesday. Uwe Hessler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Time now to hand over to Stephen Castle for our weekly briefing from Brussels.
Everyone knows that civil servants can be awkward, devious, or sometimes plain obstructive. It's rare, however, for a politician to say as much in public. This week, the European Commission Vice President, Gunter Verheugen, broke a sizable taboo with a series of blunt criticisms of his officials. First in the Süddeutsche Zeitung, then in the Financial Times, the German commissioner responsible for industry slated his officials for trying to stitch up decisions behind his back. He also suggested they were blocking policies that didn't fit their agenda. The Verheugen outburst has sent a mini shockwave through Brussels, and it's not the first time the commission vice president has done so. During the last European Commission, in which he served as Enlargement Commissioner, Mr. Verheugen caused a storm when he suggested a referendum in old member states before new ones could join. Nevertheless, old hands here have been scratching their heads about this particular episode. After all, Mr. Verheugen is hardly a newcomer to Brussels. He ought, after 7 years in the place, to know the wily ways of top bureaucrats. One explanation offered by Mr. Verheugen's critics is that he's been thrown off balance by reports in the German press about his private life. More likely is a sense of sheer exasperation about his job. Mr. Verheugen's pet project is the so-called bonfire of the regulations, a plan under which EU legislation that places unnecessary burdens on business will go up in smoke. Progress on this is proving slow, and Mr. Verheugen seems to be looking for a scapegoat. The row illustrates his sense of frustration, one that's not uncommon in the European Commission. A former Europe minister in Germany and then Enlargement Commissioner, Mr. Verheugen was an odd choice for the industry portfolio. In fact, he got the post because Berlin insisted its commissioner won an economic dossier. Axing regulation and economic reform were two of the Commission's major themes when it came into power in 2004 under José Manuel Barroso. With the European constitution in abeyance and voters disgruntled, jobs and growth have been the priority. In these areas, commissioners have found that there is a limit to what they can do. Reforming Europe's more sclerotic economies is a job for individual member states, not the EU. As for the bonfire of the regulations, no civil service is likely to be too enthusiastic. After all, the less EU legislation there is, the less there is for Eurocrats to do.
Network Europe is a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. Add your voice to ours. Send your comments and suggestions to contact@networkeurope.org. We love to hear from you. And everyone loves to hear from Stockholm, at least when it's Nobel time. The Peace Prize is the culmination of the week. But Radio Sweden can fill us in now on the prizes announced in Stockholm. Mark Cummins takes us through the 2006 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences.
American Edmund Phelps took the 2006 Economics Nobel on Monday for work in the 1960s on the link between unemployment and inflation that economists say shapes the way central banks formulate monetary policy today. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said the Columbia University professor won for challenging the assumption that cutting interest rates or taxes would give only a short-term boost to employment and create higher inflation down the road. Owning neither a house nor a car, the laureate suggested to reporters that his own lifestyle doesn't quite fit economic theory, but he did say he realized quite quickly on Monday morning what the international telephone call was about.
Well, once my wife woke me up and said that I had an international call, and I look at the clock and I saw it was a few minutes after six, so and I knew it was Monday. So those were all clues that maybe it was Stockholm calling.
And the prize that gets oh so much speculation, the Literature Prize.
The Nobel Prize in Literature for 2006 is awarded to the Turkish writer Orhan Pamuk, who in the quest for the melancholic soul of his native city has discovered new symbols for the clash and interlacing of cultures.
Bill Schiller is Radio Sweden's cultural editor. He chatted to Göran Sommerdahl of Swedish Radio.
My first reaction, oh, this young boy already a winner of the Nobel Prize. I can only think of Albert Camus, who was, I think, 46 when he received the Nobel Prize, who was a younger winner of the prize.
And how do we describe Pamuk? Is he a Turkish writer, European writer, East and West? Where is he?
Interesting enough, he's both a very Turkish and a very European writer. So I think that's why we love him so much here in the West. I think also that he represents something that we would hope that every Turk would possess. I mean, he's the ideal Turk. If every Turk would look like and be like and think like Orhan Pamuk, Turkey would be a member of the European Union tomorrow morning. He's able to merge this historic and the geographic visions into one. And most of his novels are very exciting to read.
People will certainly be shouting "School!" as they wine and dine in royal company during the Nobel ceremony in December in Stockholm. But in the Czech Republic, doctors are sounding the alarm. Women there are raising their glasses with a nazdraví far too often. In fact, in 2005, the number of women who entered Czech clinics with an alcohol abuse problem was twice as high as one decade earlier. Radio Prague's Daniela Lazarova reports.
Last week, a woman judge was dismissed from her post for not turning up to preside over an important court hearing. She was found in a drunken stupor in an entirely different courtroom. She is one of a growing number of Czech women who turn to alcohol as a means of escape from personal problems. A study just published by the Bohnice Clinic for Alcohol Abuse says the trend of alcohol abuse among women, which dates back to the 1970s, has risen sharply in the past 10 years, presenting a serious threat to women's health.
Earlier, it was very rare to see females to consume, for example, beer. Now it is very common, especially among younger generation under 30. The social norms which prevented females before from alcohol consumption does not function anymore because society accepted the drinking of females. So females drink more frequently than before, they drink more amounts of alcohol, and of course the effects of same volume of alcohol have different action on females' body.
Dr. Chemi says the pattern in female alcohol abuse is the same. Social drinking turns into secret drinking when women feel they're unable to cope with life's demands and problems. Two glasses of wine in the evening to soothe one's nerves are replaced by a shot of vodka and soon by several glasses. However, due to their body structure, women are far more at risk than men. The alcohol in their body does more harm sooner, and they become dependent at a much earlier stage. The growing problem of alcohol abuse among women dates back to the early 1970s and mirrors the situation elsewhere in Europe. Yet, unlike other European states, the Czech Republic has yet to acknowledge the problem and focus on prevention rather than consequences. Dr. Chemi again.
Alcohol dependence and drug dependence is heavily influenced by genetic factors. But if you starts to drink alcohol or to use drugs is mostly depend on environmental factors. So if we would like to use preventive measures, we should influence behavior and attitudes of people. In all Europe, there is a rather effective program called Alcohol Action Plan. And in the frame of this program, which is focused on the community and population level, some countries succeeded to reduce alcohol consumption and alcohol problems, especially France and Italy. Unfortunately, the Czech Republic does not belong to those successful countries, and the causes are lack of experienced professionals in the field of prevention, lack of financial sources for preventive measures. So what unfortunately we are doing in our country is that we are treating the adverse consequences of heavy and unhealthy drinking habits.
The clinic is now trying to establish a prevention program together with GPs, who should be the first to spot a problem and advise their patients to get help. However, in many cases, the stigma attached to alcoholics makes people deny there's anything wrong.
The stigma itself is one of the barriers which are in the way to looking for treatment in right time.
And from one vice to another, French custom authorities have crushed and burnt 9,000 tons of counterfeit cigarettes. They were part of 37 tons of cigarettes which were seized in April 2005 in the northern port of Le Havre. That's 1.8 million packs, worth more than 9 million euro. It was the biggest seizure of counterfeit tobacco in France.
Cigarettes now account for 50% of counterfeit products seized by French customs. It's a new phenomenon, and France's junior economy minister, Jean-François Copé, is determined to fight it. That's what he told journalists in a warehouse where tons of fake cigarettes were being stocked before destruction.
It's very impressive. As you can see, it's part of the 37 tons of counterfeited cigarettes that have been seized in Le Havre.
It took 2 hours for the machine to destroy 9 tons of cigarettes. That's 400,000 packs, worth more than 2 million euro. There was a heavy tobacco smell in the air as the machine was crushing the packs, but it was a feast for the eyes of managers of the world's cigarette giant, Philip Morris.
It's an excellent day. This is full cooperation with customs, and the ultimate thing is the destruction of the goods. It's an excellent day.
Constantin Duros is head of the company's brand integrity department. It signed a partnership agreement with French customs a year ago and now employs 60 people.
They just collect information, send the information, advise custom authorities.
The cigarettes were made in China, where 70% of counterfeit cigarettes are manufactured. They were stocked in lorry containers, hidden behind walls of cardboard boxes declared as shoes when shipped to Le Havre in northern France. Jean-Yves Maillet is director of customs at the busy Le Havre harbor.
Each container for smuggling, you have an error. And our job is to find this error.
Okay. They always make one mistake.
Yes, they do one mistake. I don't say which one.
French custom officers spotted the mistake and called in people from Philip Morris to make sure that they were counterfeit products. There are several ways of finding out.
Ink is different, the tear tape is different, the aluminium foil is different, the packaging is different, the cellophane is different, the cigarette is different, the filter is different. Well, you can name them.
It's more difficult to stop counterfeiters, especially since they now resort to radical measures to deliver the goods. Didier Mongin is Director General of French Customs. He tells us about a new technique called Go Fast.
They use powerful cars with V6 engines. They drive them at 200 kilometers an hour, quite often at night, and they don't hesitate to drive through and destroy toll barriers if necessary.
Criminal networks are also increasingly creative. French customs recently found 3.5 tons of counterfeit cigarettes hidden in boxes of half-melted ice cream. Paris, Nick Champeau, RFI.
And if you want to hear about France's blanket ban on smoking in public areas, go to our archives at our new website, www.networkeurope.org. Until next week, that's goodbye from us, Radio Sweden, Radio France International, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine, and Radio Slovenia. I'm Gabby Katz. Thanks for listening. And perhaps now it's time to kick back and relax. I'll leave you with one of Sweden's bright new stars, Agnes.